Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University, a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Policy Studies, an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. His latest books with Paul Pearson are Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, and American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Jacob
Hatt. Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, it's just reading your bio there. It seems like the winner-take-all politics, how Washington made the rich richer and turned its back on the middle class, should be revived and updated. I mean, this is exactly what this so-called tax reform bill is all about, isn't it?
Well, and actually, Paul Pearson, my co-author, and I have written three books on contemporary American politics, and the first was called Off Center, and it was about how Republicans had moved so dramatically to the right over the last generation. And so that trilogy of books began with our, I'm trying to choose the right word here, our puzzlement, I guess, about the GOP tax cuts of 2001, which were sort of the first example in the contemporary era of this kind of tax cut fever within the Republican Party. And those tax cuts were very skewed toward the wealthy, and they were very deceptively presented. We often told people that they were kind of like a subprime mortgage because, you know, they had this attractive veneer, but once you actually looked within the package, you saw that all of these tax cuts for the rich were designed to occur in the future. And it passed, of course, through a very partisan process in 2001. And in many ways, what we're seeing is a replay, but this time, you know, with everything magnified compared with 2001. I mean, this is a much more skewed tax cut for the rich. It is much more deceptively presented, and the gimmicks in the law are much more serious and stark. And that's partly because, of course, in 2001, we were talking about having a surplus, and now we don't have a surplus. We have huge deficits that Republicans are going to add to. And it's also partly because Republicans feel as if they got burned in 2001, that because they had to phase out some of these tax cuts in 2010 and 11, that it gave President Obama the opportunity to end some of the tax cuts for the rich. And it's ironic, but Republicans really think that they lost back in 2001 because only two-thirds of the tax cuts were continued. And the reason they think they lost is because the one-third that didn't get continued under President Obama were the tax cuts for the wealthiest. So we are seeing a playing out, essentially, of the same script that we saw in 2001, yet this time it's, you know, what began as maybe a farce is a tragedy, right? And I agree completely with your basic take on it. This is a really winner-take-all politics, and it's really about abandoning the middle class to favor those at the very top.
Yeah, but there's a big chunk of historical amnesia in the retrospective that you just gave us. What about the 2008 crash? I mean, that's the part of it that I find so extraordinary, that we, you know, the global economy is brought to its knees, and there was this painful process of Obama bringing it back. And now it seems that Donald Trump is taking credit for an economy that was revived. I mean, it reminds me of what happened in the 30s with Roosevelt rescuing capitalism and then being vilified for it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the financial crisis is a huge part of the story. It's part of the reason why Republicans were able to capitalize on public discontent after President Obama's election and regain Congress and then most recently the White House. The financial crisis is also, of course, the backdrop for some of the financial regulatory policies and ultimately for the expiration of some of the Bush tax cuts that Republicans are now railing against. And you know, I think we now understand that Donald Trump's populism is as phony as his university was, and he is the strains of his campaign that have made it into governance are the huge tax cuts for the rich and the effort to try to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which recently failed, but which parts of which have come back in this tax cut bill. So, I mean, I think it's really important to understand how unusual what Republicans are trying to do is. This is far and away the least popular piece of tax legislation in the modern age. It's even less popular than some of the tax increases that were pursued by Presidents Reagan and Bush and Clinton to try to close reduce the deficit in the 1980s and 1990s. It would seem shocking that you could run a $1.5 trillion deficit, which with a lot of gimmicks is what they say that the tax cuts will produce, that you could do that and yet produce a bill this unpopular. It seems like you're giving away $1.5 trillion. But the reason it's so unpopular is because the vast majority of Americans don't think that we should give a big tax cut to corporations and wealthy people, and that's almost entirely what this bill is about. It's certainly what all of the permanent parts of this bill are about. And, you know, I think we can say that the Republicans are on the verge of passing a bill that is almost universally disliked, even within their own party.
Well, but that's not to say that it's not going to pass, does it? I mean, the pressure for it to pass is that they want, as Lindsey Graham said, our donors are telling us, if you don't pass this,
exactly. Don't
call us for money again.
That was Chris Collins in New York, too, said
yeah.
that. I mean, that's pretty striking because that's not like something that you would expect a politician to say, right? It means that if three or four politicians are willing to say it, it means that all of them are thinking it.
Right.
And yes, no, I said on the verge. Unfortunately, there is very, very positive signs for the Republicans with regard to passage of this legislation. They've managed to, it seems like, buy off or mollify many of those who are expressing skepticism, most notably the sort of positive signals being sent by Susan Collins of Maine, who, you know, was, along with John McCain, the sort of consistent opponent of, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the most, you know, consistent opponent of the very extreme Republican health care effort earlier this year. So, and I think there are two reasons. So it's absolutely revealing, right? Not only that it's very unpopular, but that it's on the verge of passing nonetheless, because it suggests that Republicans are not only not responding to public opinion, but that they don't think that this is a catastrophic move for them. And I think politically, in earlier decades, doing something like this would have been a catastrophic move for a party. But I think they think that they've got enough donor support, enough insulation because of gerrymandering and the geographic distribution of voters, and enough insulation because of the degree to which they can throw up smoke and kind of, you know, hide what they're doing, or at least muddy the waters enough that they can squeak through. I'm not sure they're right about that, but I think it's very telling that they believe that.
Well, doesn't this then lead us back to Citizens United in the sense that we have a money-driven system, and if the donors are the ones that are being satisfied at the expense of the voters, the Republicans, if you watch the video of the protests before the Finance Committee vote, the people were being hauled out of there saying, kill the bill, shame, shame, shame. You could see on the faces of the Republicans the discomfort being confronted by their own citizens. Somewhere in their souls, I won't use any adjectives there, they must know that they're shafting the people that they represent and serving with total fealty the donors and the powerful in this country. And again, it feels to me like it gets back to that fateful Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, where the consequences seem to be clear to me that we've, as a result of this decision, we've embedded a plutocracy in America and shredded our democracy.
Well, there's no question that the role of donors and lobbyists is written all over this this legislation. I think it goes deeper than that. I think that what we've seen is the rise of a radicalized Republican Party that believes that it can pursue policies that are deeply unpopular because of the degree to which it will get support from these financial interests, and because in this age of negative partisanship, where people are you know, against the other party as, at least as much as they are for their party, that they think that a lot of the base voters for the GOP are going to vote for them nonetheless. And let's just not underestimate the degree to which Republicans do have an edge because of the distribution of voters across districts and states. You know, the estimates are that they would need to lose the popular vote in the 2018 elections. You know, they need to lose the national vote for Congress by about 5 points, so 55 to 45 in favor of the Democrats, to actually lose the House. And the Senate still seems very secure, although the Roy Moore scandal has somewhat changed the calculus. So to me, you're absolutely right in terms of thinking about what's the fundamental driving force here. The fundamental driving force here is a party that has become more and more tied to sort of the contemporary plutocracy. But in thinking about why they believe they can get away with it, I think the many ways in which our political system is not doing a very good job of representing ordinary voters' preferences come back to this insulation that Republicans think they have against the kind of backlash that we would expect when a party pursues a policy with, you know, about 20% support. And again, this is the least popular piece of tax legislation in modern memory, and that's saying something, since a lot of the tax legislation in modern memory involved tax increases, not giving away $1.5 trillion.
Well, when you talk about insulation, though, it would seem to me that where the most profound and extraordinary insulation is happening in this country is in the extent to which Donald Trump still has this core support of between 30 and 40%. And my sense is that he's insulated by his phone pal, who he talks to almost every day, Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox, because when you think about what this man is doing, you know, he's retweeting far-right fake news, anti-Muslim videos, which has appalled everybody, including the British Prime Minister. He's reviving Obama's birther conspiracy. He's claiming that Joe Scarborough killed an intern. And he's telling people that the Access Hollywood tape of him boasting about grabbing women's genitals is a fake. So this is what he's doing. And meanwhile, and I don't know whether you saw the picture of him sitting there with the empty chairs for Chuck and Nancy after he just insulted them and expected them to show up.
All saw that picture. Well, I mean, a lot of people are playing into Trump's narrative, even you know, mainstream journalists who think they're independent are picking up on this. Yeah, no, look.
This is not normal behavior.
This is all true.
This is not normal behavior. I guarantee.
No, it is not. And it's also true that this, when we talk about this insulation, we just can't ignore the way in which the media bubble in which base GOP voters are now comfortably ensconced is really reducing the chance that you're going to get serious backlash, at least among those voters. That said, you know, it, as we saw in Virginia, which of course is a blue trending state, as we saw in Virginia, there is a lot of discontent, and those numbers, you know, the 30 to 40% support for Trump, those are not good numbers for a president. So the real question, I think, is, you know, to what extent, from an electoral and political perspective, is to what extent is this piece of legislation and the more general, plutocratic push on the part of the GOP, is it going to really hurt them, hurt the party in the fall? I think if you look at why they chose to do what they did, you know, they basically have, and by the way, that means a lot of suburban Republican voters, right, are going to be crucial players in this, and those folks are getting pretty badly treated under the tax bill. So all of the kind of goodies that are in the tax bill go away in 2025 or six. I think it will depend exactly on what they choose. But the reason that they're doing the tax bill this way is that they have to fit it within this budget process. But even more so, in doing so and fitting in within this budget process, they're showing that their priority, their long-term priority, is to do the tax cuts for the rich, and that the middle-class tax cuts, such as they are, are cosmetic. So unfortunately, though, it's not clear to me that they'll be massively hurt in 2018 by this bill, simply because some of the middle-class tax cuts and the like that would affect these more suburban Republican voters will be delivered, and that it. But you know, I think this is the unpopularity of this bill is going to put to a test the Republicans' belief that they are insulated. But as you said, they have different constituencies they care about, and the one that seems to speak most loudly within the GOP right now is the donor class and the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, even the progressive precincts of the business community, like, you know, Apple and Google, that would just love to be able to repatriate a lot of the cash they're sitting on with low corporate tax rates.
Well, then, does this, just in conclusion here, does this mean, Jacob Hacker, that perhaps we're not looking at the right picture or the real picture, that we are distracted by Trump's daily whipsawing the attention of the press with bizarre behavior, and we're not looking at who's really reaping the rewards of this government? In other words, when you talk about chaos, as Jeb Bush did, there seems to be, in midst all the chaos, there seems to be some real winners so far. And you mentioned the Koch brothers a minute ago.
Yeah.
If you look at the only things that the House has gotten done, mostly through changing regulations, have been benefiting the Koch brothers. Offshore drilling, opening up Keystone, crippling the EPA. That's the Koch brothers' wish list. Now you add to that this tax bill, which is furthering the Koch brothers' wish list, getting rid of the estate tax, you know, which is going to destroy American philanthropy. There's no incentive now for the, you know, Rockefeller Fund, the Ford Foundation, etc., that have done so much good in this country. They just pass on all their money to their kids and consolidate an oligarchy. So are we not really watching the ball here?
We're not watching the ball. I mean, there are people watching the ball, but I think the healthcare debate was instructive, right? The reason I think in the end that Republicans failed, and they came awfully close on healthcare, and they're going to, as you know, they're reviving parts of the healthcare bill in the tax legislation. Notably, they're getting rid of the individual requirement to have coverage. But the reason that they failed was, I think, in the end, that there was enough visibility of the effort and what it would do, and enough pressure on them. And of course, healthcare is different from tax cuts in that it involves imposing a lot of pain in the near term, and lots of people are going to lose their coverage, and lots of people were able to tell sympathetic stories about the ways in which they've been helped by the Affordable Care Act. So the reason they lost was because this did not happen in the dead of night. It did not, in the end, it was not possible for them to hide what they were doing. But this time around with the tax cut bill, it's abstruse, it's complicated, and there's so much stuff that's being thrown up. You know, all of these kind of cultural outrages and other, you know, Trumpian tweeting kinds of distractions are making it hard, I think, for Americans to really see what's going on or to get mobilized around it. And the time is running out for that. And, you know, I don't want to be too pessimistic, because I think there's a real chance that even if this bill passes, that it will prove to be a very significant albatross around the neck of Republicans in the future, and it should be, right? You shouldn't be able to pass stuff that people don't want and not pay a price for it. But I think we should recognize that this is a significant failure of democracy as we understand it, which is the idea that, you know, things should happen when they are broadly popular, that people shouldn't have influence simply because they have massive amounts of money, because this is really a bill by, of, and for the top 0.1%, not a bill that's by, of, and for the people.
Well, Dr. Jacob Hacker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University and a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Policy Studies and an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. His latest books with Paul Pearson are Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, and American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump has taken his complaints about the press abroad and made common cause with leaders who are either murdering, jailing, or taking control of their press.